Chapter 5. Sandecker and Gunn followed Laird out of the elevator across a circular reception room guarded by a Secret Service agent and into a library whose four walls were packed from floor to ceiling with over 1,000 books. As the door was closed behind him, Sandecker saw the president standing in the center of the room, his eyes fixed on the admiral but showing no trace of recognition. There were three other men in the room. One Sandecker knew. The other two were unfamiliar. The president held a coffee cup in his left hand as Laird made the introductions. "Mr. President, Admiral James Sandecker and Commander Rudy Gunn." The president gave the impression of being older than he was. He looked 65, but was still in his late 50s. The premature gray hair, red veins streaming through his facial skin, the beady eyes that always seemed reddened, inspired political cartoonists often to caricature him as a wino, when, in fact, he rarely drank anything more than an occasional glass of beer. He was an intense man with a round face and low forehead and thin eyebrows. He was the consummate politician. Within days of replacing his ailing boss, no decision regarding his lifestyle or the state of the union was made without considering the potential for gathering votes for his run for office in the next election. Dean Cooper Wallace would not become one of Sandecker's favorite presidents. It was no secret that Wallace detested Washington and refused to play the required social games. He and the Congress pulled in harness together like a lion and a bear, both wanting to eat the other. He was not an intellectual, but was adept at cutting deals and acting on intuition. Since replacing the man who had been duly elected, he had quickly surrounded himself with aides and advisers who shared his distrust of the entrenched bureaucracy and were always looking for innovative ways to circumvent tradition. The president extended his free hand while still holding the coffee cup. "Admiral Sandecker, a pleasure to finally meet you." Sandecker involuntarily blinked. The president's grip was anything but hearty, not what he expected from a politician who pressed flesh year in and year out. "Mr. President, I hope this will be only the first of many times we meet face to face." "I expect so, since the prognosis for my predecessor is not good for a full recovery." "I'm sorry to hear it. He is a good man." Wallace did not reply. He merely nodded at Gunn, acknowledging his presence, as Laird continued playing host. The chief of staff took the admiral by the arm and led him over to the three men standing in front of a gas fire that burned in a stone fireplace. "Duncan Monroe, Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and his executive associate commissioner for field operations, Peter Harper." Monroe had a tough, no-nonsense look about him. Harper seemed as if he melted into the bookcase behind him. Laird turned to the third man. "Admiral Dale Ferguson, Commandant of the Coast Guard." "Dale and I are old friends," said Sandecker. A large, ruddy man with a ready smile, Ferguson gripped Sandecker by the shoulder. "Good to see you, Jim." "How are Sally and the kids? I haven't seen them since we took that cruise together around Indonesia." "Sally is still saving the forests, and the boys are wiping out my pension with their college expenses." Impatient with the small talk, the president gathered them all around a conference table and kicked off the meeting. "I apologize for asking you to leave your beds on a rainy night, but Duncan has brought to my attention a crisis that is exploding on our doorstep that involves illegal immigration. I'm counting on you gentlemen to come up with a viable program to cut the flow of aliens, particularly the Chinese who are being smuggled across our shorelines in vast numbers." Sandecker raised his eyebrows, puzzled. "I can certainly see, Mr. President, where INS and the Coast Guard fit into the picture. But what does unlawful immigration have to do with the National Underwater and Marine Agency? Our work is based on underwater research. Chasing down Chinese smugglers is out of our territory." "We're in dire need of any source that can help us," said Duncan Munro. "With congressional budget cuts, INS is overstretched far beyond our capacity. Congress appropriated a 60% increase in INS Border Patrol agents, but provided no funds for expanding our investigations division. Our entire department has only 1,800 special agents to cover the entire United States and foreign investigations. The FBI has 1,100 agents in New York City alone. Here in Washington, 1,200 Capitol Police patrol an area that is measured in city blocks. Simply put, there are nowhere near enough INS criminal investigative assets to put a dent in the flow of illegal immigrants. Sounds like you're operating with an army of patrolmen on the beat, but few detectives to back them up, said Sandecker. We fight a losing battle as it is with illegals pouring across our border with Mexico, many who come from as far away as Chile and Argentina, Munro continued. We might as well hold back ocean surf with kitchen sieves. People smuggling has grown into a multi-billion dollar industry that rivals arms and drug smuggling. Moving human cargo in an underworld apathetic to borders and political ideologies, people smuggling will be the major crime of the 21st century. Harper inclined his head. To make matters worse, large-scale alien smuggling from the People's Republic of China is reaching epidemic proportions. Smugglers, with the blessing and support of their government, who are looking to decrease their tremendous population any way they can, have launched a program to export tens of millions of their people to every corner of the globe, especially to Japan, the U.S. and Canada, Europe and South America. Strange as it sounds, they're even infiltrating the whole of Africa from Cape Town to Algiers. Harper continued for his boss. The smuggling syndicates have organized a complex labyrinth of transportation routes. Air, sea, and land are all used to smuggle human cargo. Over 40 advanced staging and dispersion areas have been set up throughout Eastern Europe, Central America, and Africa. The Russians are especially hard hit, added Munro. They see massive, uncontrolled migration of Chinese nationals into Mongolia and Siberia as a threat to their security. The Intelligence Directorate of the Russian Defense Ministry has warned their leaders that Russia is on the verge of losing its Far Eastern territories because the flow of Chinese is already accounting for a greater part of the population in the region. Mongolia is already a lost cause, said the president. Russia has allowed her power base to slip through her fingers. Siberia is next. As if reading lines from a play, Harper chimed in again. Before Russia forfeits her ports in the Pacific, with rich deposits of gold, oil, and gas, all vital for her entry into the exploding Asia-Pacific economy, her president and his parliament may out of desperation declare war on China. That would make for an impossible situation for the United States to choose sides. Well, there is also another cataclysm in the making, said the president. The gradual takeover of Eastern Russia is only the tip of the iceberg. The Chinese think in the long term. Besides the impoverished peasants being rounded up and loaded aboard ships, a great many migrants are by no means poor. Many have the financial means to buy property and launch businesses in whichever country they settle. Given enough time, this can lead to enormous changes in political and economic influence, particularly if their culture and loyalty remain tied to the mother country. If the tide of Chinese migration goes unchecked, said Laird, there is no predicting the enormous upheaval the world will experience in the next 100 years. It sounds to me like you're implying the People's Republic of China is engaged in a Machiavellian scheme to take over the world, said Sandecker. Munro nodded. They're in it up to their necks. China's mass of humanity is growing by 21 million people a year. Their population of 1.2 billion represents 22% of the world's total people. Yet their land area is only 7%. Starvation is a fact of life over there. Laws enacted to allow couples only one child to slow the birth rate are a drop in the bucket. Poverty breeds children despite threats of prison. China's leaders see illegal immigration as a simple and inexpensive solution to their population problem. By literally licensing criminal syndicates that specialize in smuggling, they capitalize on both ends of the spectrum. The profits can be nearly as high as trafficking in drugs, and they decrease the numbers of those who drain their economy. Gunn looked across the table at the INS commissioners. It was always my impression that organized crime syndicates directed the smuggling operations. Monroe nodded toward Harper. I'll let Peter reply, since he is our expert on Asian organized crime and transnational criminal groups. There are two sides to the smuggling, explained Harper. One is operated by an alliance of criminal groups that also deals in drugs, extortion, prostitution, and international car theft. They account for nearly 30% of aliens smuggled into Europe and the Western Hemisphere. The second is legitimate business fronts that engage in the traffic from behind the cloak of respectability, licensed and supported by their governments. This part of the activity accounts for 70% of all aliens run across world borders. Although many illegal Chinese immigrants come in by air, the great mass cross into foreign countries by sea. Air requires passports and heavy bribery. The use of ships to smuggle aliens has become more widespread. The overhead costs are lower. Many more bodies can be transported in one operation. The logistics are simpler, and the profits are higher. Admiral Ferguson cleared his throat and said, When the flood was a trickle, old dilapidated and run-down tramp freighters were used to transport the immigrants before sending them ashore in leaky boats and rafts. Many were given life jackets and thrown over the side. Hundreds drowned before reaching the beach. Now the smugglers have become far more sophisticated, secreting the immigrants in commercial shipping, and with an increasing number of cases, the smugglers sail brazenly into port before sneaking them past immigration agents. What happens after the immigrants safely arrive in the country? Asked Gunn. Local Asian crime gangs take over, Harper answered. Those immigrants lucky enough to have money or relatives already living in the U.S. are released directly into their destination community. Most, however, cannot pay the fee for entry. Consequently, they are forced to remain concealed, generally in remote warehouses. Here they are locked away for weeks or even months, and threatened by being told that if they try to escape, they will be turned over to American law enforcement and imprisoned for half their lives merely because they are illegal entrants. The gangs frequently use torture, beatings, and rape to frighten the captives into signing their lives away as indentured servants. Once the aliens cave in, they are forced to work for the crime syndicates in drug dealing, prostitution, in illegal sweatshops, and other gang-related activities. Those in good physical condition, usually the younger men, must sign a contract requiring them to repay their smuggling fee at high rates of interest. Then they are found jobs in laundries, restaurants, or manufacturing, working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. It takes from 6 to 8 years for the illegal immigrant to pay off his debt. After obtaining the necessary forged documents, many of them become bona fide American citizens, Monroe continued. As long as the United States has a demand for cheap labor, efficient smuggling enterprises will exploit it with illegal immigration that is already increasing to epidemic proportions. Well, there must be any number of ways to cut off the flow, Sandecker said, helping himself to a cup of coffee from a silver urn on a nearby cart. Short of throwing up an international blockade around the Chinese mainland, how can you stop them? Asked Gunn. The answer is simple, replied Laird. We can't, certainly not under international law. Our hands are tied. All any nation can do, including the United States, is recognize the threat as a major international security concern and take whatever emergency measures that are required to protect its borders. They're like calling out the Army and Marines to defend the beaches and repel invaders, suggested Sandecker wryly. The President gave Sandecker a sharp look.
You seem to have missed the point, Admiral. What we are facing is a peaceful invasion. I simply can't whistle up a curtain of missiles against unarmed men, women, and children.
Sandecker pressed on.
Then what's stopping you, Mr. President, from directing a joint operation by the armed forces to effectively seal our borders? By doing so, you'd probably cut the flow of illegal drugs into the country as well.
The President shrugged.
The thought has crossed smarter minds than mine.
Stopping illegals is not the mission of the Pentagon, said Laird firmly.
Perhaps I've been misinformed. But I've always been under the impression that the mission of our armed forces was to protect and defend the security of the United States. Peaceful or not, I still read this as an invasion of our foreign shores. I see no reason why Army, Infantry, and Marine divisions can't help Mr. Monroe's understaffed border patrolmen, why the Navy can't back up Admiral Ferguson's overextended Coast Guard, and why the Air Force can't fly aerial reconnaissance missions.
There are political considerations beyond my control, the President said, a certain hardness creeping into his voice. Like not retaliating with tough trade sanctions on Chinese imports because they buy billions of dollars worth of industrial and agricultural products from us every year?
While you're on that subject, Admiral, said Laird with emphasis, you should be aware that the Chinese have replaced the Japanese as the biggest purchaser of U.S. Treasury bonds. It is not in our best interest to harass them.
Gunn could see the anger reddening his chief's face, while the President's was turning pale. He stepped into the debate quietly.
I'm sure Admiral Sandecker understands your difficulties, Mr. President, but I believe we're both in the dark as to how NUMA can help.
I'll be happy to brief you on your involvement, Jim, said Ferguson to his old friend.
Please do, Sandecker said testily.
It's no secret the Coast Guard is stretched too thin. Over the past year, we've seized 32 vessels and intercepted over 4,000 illegal Chinese aliens off Hawaii and the east and west coasts. NUMA has a small fleet of research vessels.
Stop right there, interrupted Sandecker.
There is no way I will permit my ships and scientists to stop and board vessels suspected of carrying illegal immigrants.
Not our intention to put weapons in the hands of marine biologists, Ferguson assured the Admiral, his voice calm and unperturbed.
What we need from NUMA is information on possible alien landing sites, undersea conditions and geology along our coastlines, bays and inlets that the smugglers can take advantage of. Put your best people on it, Jim. Where would they offload their human cargo if they were the smugglers?
Also, added Monroe, your people and vessels can act as intelligence gatherers. NUMA's turquoise-painted ships are known and respected throughout the world as ocean science research vessels. Any one of them could sail within 100 yards of a suspected ship filled with aliens without arousing the suspicions of the smugglers. They can report what they observe and continue on with their research.
You must understand, said the President wearily to Sandecker. I'm not asking you to drop your agency's priorities, but I am ordering you and NUMA to give whatever assistance possible to Mr. Monroe and Admiral Ferguson to reduce the flow of illegal aliens from China into the United States.
There are two particular areas we'd like your people to investigate, said Harper.
I'm listening, muttered Sandecker, beginning to show a faint trace of curiosity.
Are you familiar with a man by the name of Chin Chang? Asked Harper.
I am, answered Sandecker. He owns a shipping empire called Chin Chang Maritime Limited out of Hong Kong that operates a fleet of over 100 cargo ships, oil tankers, and cruise ships. He once made a personal request through a Chinese historian to search our data files for a shipwreck he was interested in finding. If it floats, Shang probably owns it, including dockside facilities and warehouses in nearly every major port city in the world. He is as shrewd and canny as they come.
Isn't Shang the Chinese mogul who built that huge port facility in Louisiana? Asked Gunn.
One and the same, answered Ferguson. On Atchafalaya Bay near Morgan City. Nothing but marshlands and bayous. According to every developer we questioned, there is absolutely no logic in pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into a shipping port 80 miles from the nearest major city and with no transportation network leading from it.
Has it got a name? Inquired Gunn.
The port is called Sungari. Shang must have damn good reason for throwing big money into a swamp, said Sandecker.
Whatever his logic, we've yet to learn what it is, Monroe admitted. That's one of two areas where NUMA can help us.
You'd like to use a NUMA research ship and its technology to nose around Shang's newly constructed shipping port, assumed Gunn. Ferguson nodded.
You get the picture, Commander. There's more to Sungari than what meets the eye, and it's probably out of sight underwater.
The President stared pointedly at Sandecker with a faint smile.
No other government agency has the brains and technology of NUMA for underwater investigation.
Sandecker stared back.
You haven't made it clear what Shang has to do with alien smuggling.
According to our intelligence sources, Shang is the mastermind responsible for 50% of the Chinese smuggled into the Western Hemisphere, and the number is growing rapidly.
So, if you stop Shang, you cut off the head of the snake.
The President nodded briefly.
That's pretty much our theory.
You mentioned two areas for us to investigate, Sandecker probed.
Ferguson held up a hand to field the question.
The second is a ship. Another of Shang's projects we can't fathom was his purchase of the former transatlantic ocean liner, the SS United States.
The United States went out of service and was laid up at Norfolk, Virginia for 30 years, said Gunn. Monroe shook his head.
10 years ago, she was sold to a Turkish millionaire, who advertised that he was going to refit and put her into service as a floating university.
Not a practical scheme, Sandecker said bluntly. No matter how she's refitted, by today's standards, she's too large and too expensive to operate and maintain.
A deception.
For the first time, Monroe grinned.
The rich Turk turned out to be our friend, Chin Shang. The United States was towed from Norfolk across the sea into the Mediterranean, past Istanbul and into the Black Sea to Sevastopol. The Chinese do not have a dry dock that can take a ship that size. Shang hired the Russians to convert her into a modern cruise ship.
It makes no sense. He'll lose his shirt, he must know that.
It makes a lot of sense if Shang intends to use the United States as a cover to move illegal aliens, said Ferguson. The CIA also thinks the People's Republic bankrolled Shang. The Chinese have a small navy. If they should ever get serious about invading Taiwan, they'll need troop transports. The United States could transport an entire division, including their heavy arms and equipment.
I fully understand that sinister threats call for urgent measures.
Sandecker paused and massaged his temples with his fingertips for a few moments. Then he announced,
"The resources of NUMA are at your command. We'll give it our best effort."
The President nodded as though he had expected that.
"Thank you, Admiral. I'm sure Mr. Monroe and Admiral Ferguson join me in expressing our gratitude."
Gunn's thoughts were already on the job ahead.
"It would be most helpful," he said, his eyes on Monroe and Harper, "if you had agents on the inside of Shang's organization to feed us information."
Monroe made a helpless gesture with his hands.
"Shang's security is incredibly tight. He's hired a top group of former Russian KGB agents to form an impenetrable ring that even the CIA has yet to infiltrate. They have a computerized personnel identification and investigation system that is second to none. There is no one within Shang's own management circles who is not under constant surveillance.
To date, added Harper, we've lost 2 special agents who attempted to penetrate Shang's organization. Except for one of our agents who posed as an immigrant and bought her passage on board one of Shang's smuggling ships, our undercover missions are in shambles. I hate to admit such failure, but those are the hard facts.
Your agent is a woman? Asked Sandecker.
Comes from a wealthy Chinese family. She's one of our best.
Any idea where the smugglers will put your agent ashore? Asked Gunn.
Harper shook his head. We are not in contact with her. They could drop her and the rest of the illegal immigrants anywhere between San Francisco and Anchorage.
How do you know Shang's security people haven't already caught on to her, as they did your other 2 agents?
Harper's eyes remained fixed in space for a long time. Finally, he admitted solemnly, We don't. All we can do is wait and hope until she makes contact with one of our West Coast district offices.
And if you never hear from her?
Harper gazed down at the polished surface of the table, as if seeing the unthinkable. Then I send a letter of condolence to her parents and assign someone else to follow in her footsteps.
The meeting finally concluded at 4 o'clock in the morning. Sandecker and Gunn were ushered from the president's secret quarters and returned through the tunnel to the White House. As they were driven to their respective homes in the limousine, each man was lost in gloomy thoughts. Finally, Sandecker broke the somber mood.
They must be desperate if they need Numa to help bail them out.
I'd probably call in the Marines, the New York Stock Exchange, and the Boy Scouts, too, if I was in the President's shoes, said Gunn.
A farce, snorted Sandecker. My sources in the White House tell me the President has been in bed with Chin Shang since he was governor of Oklahoma.
Gunn looked at him.
But the President said,
I know what he said, but what he meant is a different thing. Naturally, he wants the flow of illegal immigrants stopped, but he won't order any measures that might upset Beijing. Chin Shang is President Wallace's chief campaign fundraiser in Asia. Many millions of dollars from the Chinese government were funneled through Hong Kong and Chin Shang Maritime into Wallace's campaign fund. It's corrupt influence peddling of the highest order. That's why Wallace stops short of any head-to-head confrontation. His administration is riddled with people working on China's behalf. The man has sold his soul to the detriment of American citizens.
Then what does he hope to gain if we nail Chin Shang's ass to the wall?
It won't happen, said Sandecker acidly. Chin Shang will never be indicted nor convicted of criminal activities, certainly not in the United States.
Then I gather it's your plan to push ahead in the investigation, said Gunn. Regardless of the consequences.
Sandecker nodded.
Do we have a research ship operating in the Gulf?
The Marine Denizen. Her scientific team is conducting a study on the diminishing coral reefs off Yucatan.
She served Numa for a long time, Sandecker said, visualizing the ship.
The oldest in our fleet, Gunn acknowledged. This is her final voyage. After she returns to port in Norfolk, we're donating her to the Lampak University of Oceanography.
The university will have to wait a while longer. An old marine research ship with a crew of biologists should prove an ideal cover to investigate Chang's port facility.
Who have you in mind to lead the investigation?
Sandecker turned to Gunn.
Our special projects director, who do you think?
Gunn hesitated.
Asking a bit much from Dirk, aren't we?
Can you think of a better man?
No, but he took quite a beating on the last project. When I saw him a few days ago, he looked like death warmed over. He needs more time to mend.
Pitt is a fast healer, Sandecker said confidently. A challenge is just what he needs to get back into the swim of things. Track him down and tell him it's essential he contact me immediately.
I don't know where to reach him, Gunn said vaguely. After you gave him a month's leave, he just took off without saying where he was going.
He's in Washington State, up to his old tricks at a place called Orion Lake.
Gunn looked at the Admiral suspiciously. How do you know that?
Hiram Yeager sent him a truckload of underwater gear, said Sandecker, his eyes glinting like a fox's. Hiram thought he did it on the sly, but word has a funny way of filtering up to my office.
Not much goes on around Numa that you don't know about.
The only mystery I haven't solved is how Al Giordino smokes my expensive Nicaraguan cigars when I never find any missing.
Did it ever occur to you that you both might have the same source?
Impossible, snorted Sandecker. My cigars are rolled by a family who are close friends of mine in Managua. Giordino couldn't possibly know them. And while we're on the subject, where is Giordino?
Lying on a beach in Hawaii, answered Gunn. He decided it was as good a time as any to take a vacation until Dirk got back in the saddle again.
Those two are usually as thick as thieves. It's a rare moment when they're not causing mischief together.
You want me to brief Al on the situation and then send him out to Orion Lake to bring Dirk back to Washington? Sandecker nodded.
A good idea. Pitt will listen to Giordino. You go along as backup. Knowing Dirk, if I called and ordered him to report back to work, he'd hang up the phone.
You're absolutely right, Admiral, Gunn said, smiling. That's exactly what he would do.